The views and opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Novant Health, Optum, Sentra Health, Augusta Health, or the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association.
Welcome to The Shift, RCM Talks, where we share actionable insights from industry leaders who have firsthand experience and knowledge in revenue cycle. The revenue cycle management industry is evolving rapidly, requiring professionals to adapt quickly to new trends. Revenue cycle professionals no longer have the luxury of time. Our content delivers critical information in short episodes that you can use and share. We'll provide you with quick insights, help you navigate change, improve performance, and lead with confidence. Please join Bill Eichest, Valerie Barkoff, and Heather Dunn as we continue our commitment to make revenue cycle fun, informative, and collaborative. I hope you'll join us. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Shift, RCM Talks. I'm Bill Eichest, and I'm joined today by Valerie Barkoff, Senior Vice President of Operations Revenue Cycle Transformation at Optum, and Heather Dunn, Chief Revenue Cycle Officer with Novant Health. And we're lucky to have two very special guests with us today from the state of Virginia, Katie Adams, Chief Revenue Officer at Augusta Health in Fishersville, Virginia, and Bob Booth, VP and Chief Revenue Officer at Sentra Health in Lynchburg, Virginia. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you guys for joining.
Thanks for having us.
We really appreciate you joining us today. We wanted to talk with you about the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association Payer Advisory Committee. It's really a great group that the State of Virginia Hospital Association has put together. We want to know more about the work that y'all are doing with your provider colleagues and to improve or at least positively impact the relationship between providers and payers. But first, why don't you both tell us a little bit about your areas of responsibility at Augusta Health and Sentra Health?
Hi, I'm Katie Adams. As Bill mentioned, I'm the Chief Revenue Officer, the very first Chief Revenue Officer that we have had here at Augusta Health. So very proud of that.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I have full oversight of revenue cycle operations from patient access, front end revenue cycle, mid revenue cycle, and back end revenue cycle for the hospital, the medical group, our ancillaries such as home health and hospice, and have recently found myself in payer negotiation space. So I'm also now leading the efforts for payer contracting, payer management, and payer relations.
Thanks, Katie. That's great. Bob, how about you?
Hey, everyone. This is Bob Booth. I'm also with the same exact title, the Vice President and Chief Revenue Officer at Sentra Health in Lynchburg, Virginia. I actually do just about the same thing that Katie does, the same responsibilities, end-to-end revenue cycle, managed care and managed care negotiations, which has always been a lot of fun, and oversight of our five hospitals and our 700 member physician practices.
I like that you described it as fun. I mentioned in our prep session that I was responsible for negotiating the managed care contracts for one of my previous employers. You know what? I didn't see it as fun. So I'm glad there's people out there like you who love it. I like to go back to the numbers and the revenue cycle. So I'm excited to hear what you guys are doing. And especially, you know, if you have fun at it, you're going to really move the needle and help the provider. So
it's an interesting concept too, right? Like this is new, having a revenue cycle also be responsible for managed care. And like, I've seen that happen in a couple of different places, but I'm super interested to hear the good in all of that and some of the things you've been able to eliminate, the friction that's eliminated, but then the friction that gets created. That's always the, you know, the flip side.
Heather, I was just going to say, it's a unique opportunity because, you know, when we're talking with payers, negotiating a new contract or a renewal, I'm thinking about the back end of the revenue cycle, which a managed care person, you know, in all their experience, you know, if that's all they do, and I say that with respect, that they're not thinking about the plight of our follow-up people or our billers or our denial people. And I am. And I'm thinking about eliminating as much of the avenues that a payer has to deny a claim, delay a claim as possible. Where, yes, a managed care professional is going to think about that. They're probably going to coordinate with their revenue cycle leader. They should. And they have in my career where it's been part of it. But I enjoy, and that's where I think I got the enjoyment from, is that I'm able to think about how it impacts our back-end folks right at the front end when we're talking about the agreement.
Right.
There's a lot of positives.
I remember telling managed care folks, like, if you can put it into on paper, but if you can't operationalize it, then why did you negotiate it, right? Like, I remember there was this one term for a payer where they had to let the patients, like, if we had put in a request for a discharge, they had to reply to it within so many hours. And I said, that's great. How are we going to measure that? Well, that's mm-hmm. all for you guys to figure out, right? Like, yeah, because, yeah, you know, every single day we're putting in exactly the right information into our EMR where we can have a data-driven result for you and we can hold the payer accountable. But
I used to always think about, well, how am I going to adjudicate what you guys negotiated, right? How am I going to make that happen? And a lot of times I couldn't, which is how I ended up, and then we'll pivot, Bob, and let you like get us back on track. But that's how I ended up getting managed care contracting, is when I was part of Promina here in Atlanta. And when Promina fell apart, my CFO is like, well, you seem to be the one who knows how the bills get paid. Do you want to take over contracting to make sure that our terms line up? Because I was the loudest, squeakiest wheel going, I can't operationalize X, Y, or Z. So maybe you guys have figured out the nut, and it's going to be a model we can, you know, share to other people.
I found the opposite was true too. If I can add just one more comment, there is when we had a separate managed care lead who was not part of revenue cycle operations, but she would include us on things like language, where she's redlined the documents. She would maybe get hung up on something that the materiality of that clause was not that big of a deal. And so it watered down the arguments of other clauses that were a big deal for us. Right. So I found the opposite was true as well.
Yeah. Katie and Bob, can you talk a little bit more about the purpose of the payer advisory committee? Who's represented on the committee and how you both got involved?
Sure, I'll take a crack at that. So the payer advisory committee is representative of, I don't know if every single Virginia hospital is represented there, but if not, it's a great majority of them. There are individuals who have only revenue cycle oversight in the committee. There are individuals who have only managed care and payer relations on the committee. And then there's folks like Bob and I who kind of straddle both of those lines. I have a fun, and I'll make it quick, story about how I got involved in the payer advisory committee, but I think I have to go back to the age of 19 when my very first job in the corporate world was an inpatient follow-up representative. And I joke with everyone that this is a career that chose me. I'll never forget at the age of 24 years old when I had an 18-month-old son who had RSV and found myself with him being intubated for 28 days in the UVA PICU, pediatric intensive care unit. At the time, I was a business systems coordinator at UVA, and that's where a lot of the dots connected for me. I've heard Bob talk about how his dots connected when he has gone through healthcare as a patient. And I knew that I didn't want to be patient care, but I knew that I wanted to do something to help hospital systems and healthcare organizations. So I said, that and involvement with AHAM, I buckled up. This was going to be my career, and I was going to make the most of it. So here I am a few years later, just a couple, in this seat. And I started joining the payer advisory committee, frankly, as just a stand-in for my CFO, who was part of the acting committee at the time. And, you know, CFOs are really busy, so he was very frequently not able to join the committee. So I became a permanent member. Got involved, started opening my eyes, broadening my horizons, learning, networking, and becoming vocal. And the next thing I knew, I got invited to be the vice chair and then the chair. So that was my journey to be on the Payer Advisory Committee.
It's great. How about for you, Bob?
Yeah, mine's similar. I'm a little longer in the tooth than Katie has been doing this for a while. But I came to Virginia sight unseen in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. I can't say I've never driven through Virginia because I might have, but I've never been in Virginia. And I had an opportunity. I had a former CFO that came here and, you know, has said, hey, this is a great opportunity. And I'm like, yeah, what the heck? Middle of a pandemic. Let's go across. I was in Arizona. Let's go to Virginia. Great decision. Really love being here. The Payer Advisory Committee was really a light in the dark for me because I've been doing this a long time. I've seen a lot of things. I've worked nationally. I've traveled for a big company. I've seen a lot of the national issues. But Virginia has its own little set of things going on and payer issues and things going on. The VHHA was a perfect vehicle to get me acclimated to, you know, what's going on in the Commonwealth of Virginia because it's different. The players are different. And I joined it. Found out so much information. Cannot thank Craig, the leader of that committee from the VHHA, you know, who was there enough for just the wealth of information they provide for all of us, you know, as we fight these common issues that we all deal with. And, you know, and then seeing, you know, Katie was the vice chair and the chair. I became the vice chair under her reign of terror. And then I became the chair here in 25, and I handed over in a little while. But it's been in my 30 plus year career, it's been one of the best groups I've been a part of. And I've seen some great HFMA groups and AHAM groups. But this state level group, one of the strongest, best teams that I've been a part of since I've been doing it.
So
that's really great.
I have to ask. As a revenue cycle leader for a long, long time, like I agree with you, Katie, it chooses you. You don't choose it. Help me understand how this has made your relationships with payers better. Has it changed anything about your point of view? Has it changed anything about how you approach things? Give the revenue cycle leaders of the world some hope that there's like a great relationship at the end of the tunnel.
It's definitely changed the way I look at not only payer relations, but payer policies. From my perspective, the Payer Advisory Committee has changed my vantage point. And what I mean by that is if a payer policy comes out or a payer issue is identified, it's no longer just about me being the lone warrior out there trying to figure this out on my own. But there is, as Bob mentioned about the committee, there's a group of us that are able to speak to it. And we come together on a monthly basis and discuss issues or challenges that we might have. It has also helped me understand and process things through multiple filters. Like I said, it's no longer about what does this mean for Augusta Health? But being involved in the Payer Advisory Committee, I'm now thinking, is this policy legal? Does it violate any type of Virginia code? Is this acceptable through the MAA final rule, which Craig is really good about keeping us informed about all of these things that have payer connections? Is this going to impact more than just me? Is it going to impact the state? And frankly, I've had a lot of leaders here at Augusta Health who have helped mentor me and understand how big advocacy is. It's bigger than just my hospital. It's bigger than just my organization. From that perspective, it's almost given me more to process as I work through my daily life is not only what is this one denied claim in front of me, but how does it impact the industry as a whole, the state, and what can we do about it? I kind of choose not to walk through life with skepticism in my personal life. But you can't help but to have some layer of skepticism whenever you see these new policies. There's one that was released just recently, which I won't call out by name, but it's got all of our attention. And the payer puts on a lens that this is going to be beneficial for providers. But when on the surface, it may look that way. But when you really start to process the impact, you're going, hold on a second. This is bigger than what it looks like in the few couple pages of a payer policy bulletin that's been put out there. And those are things that in a room together as a payer advisory committee, we can process through. So I wouldn't say my relationships with payers have, or my view of payers have gotten better or worse, but definitely thinking through them with a different lens. So that's my initial, I mean, there is an opportunity for collaboration. We do invite the payers to our payer advisory committee and we use aggregated data to show them. And we have seen one actual local payer in the area be very transparent about where they're experiencing challenges in their claims processing spaces and have made promises to us to make that better. And we're holding them accountable to that. So there is power in coming together and being collaborative with them as well.
Bob, how about you? Has anything changed for you?
One thing I try not to lose sight of, Heather, is the payer is our adversary. I'm going to use, you know, a sense of humor and, you know, positive communication. I'm not quite as good at it as Katie is, but you have to level set and realize this is your adversary across the table from you. You're here to get your claims paid for the appropriate care at the appropriate time at the appropriate amount. They do not have the same process. They do not have the same goal in mind. Their goal is to minimize their exposure and pay as little as possible and move on from there. So as long as you level set and keep that in the back of your mind, yes, you can use a lot of this communication. Because if I come at you and say, I'm having this problem with you, it seems very individual. But if it's we're having this problem with you, we, as in all of us in Virginia, do not like this policy. We don't think it's legal. We think it's against Virginia code. With an organization behind us to support that in the VHHA, that's powerful because it's not, no matter how big your health system is, a large system, medium, a smaller system, you're still one voice. You're still advocating for your company as you as a person, and that becomes very adversarial. When you come at it as a team and say, we as a united group feel that this is inappropriate and we want to talk about this and you need to do better, you need to pay claims better, it's the same thing. You're saying the same exact thing, but it's not a one-on-one, you know, pointed accusatory kind of thing. It's a, we are all together here. We want to know how we can work with you to get it done. But let's not confuse that they're not your friends and they're not here to make your life better. You still have to push for what you have to push for. It's the messaging that gets better.
Well, I was going to say, it's always been kind of an unfair balance too, right? Even the largest health system cannot stack up against the largest payer, right? So the more that the providers come together, the bigger the voice and the bigger the issue. Maybe share some of the ways that you think the committee has been helping the providers make a difference. I would imagine that, you know, you mentioned even the large health systems benefit from this. I would imagine some of the smaller ones who don't have the time, the resources, the investment dollars to do a payer scorecard are definitely benefiting from this. But maybe share some of the ways that the providers have benefited from the committee.
Sure. I mean, I think in its simplest form, the VHHA, who has a lot of influence and connection with the AHA and who helps us shape possible legislation. So they will get recommendations from the committee members. So a policy or something will come out or process is broken or whatever. And the VHHA will say, how is this impacting you? Is this impacting everyone? How can we be there to support? So that is making a difference in providers. And I talked about the collaboration a minute ago. I had the privilege of sitting on a work group that was addressing some of the Virginia code on Fair Business Practices Act. And payers were in the room, providers were in the room, and we both had our different positions. Some of those, we weren't going to change each other's minds, right? You're stuck in this, I'm stuck in here. But where is our common ground? And where can we come up with what's being called consensus recommendations to present to the Bureau of Insurance to potentially put into law? And we were able to do that. You know, the conversations were very passionate on both sides, but we found some commonality. It's not nothing to put on a billboard, but it's micro steps to building a collaborative relationship. And that's, I think that's been helpful, the VHHA having our voice, working with the payers to come up with consensus recommendations and actually impacting change.
And I think I can add to that a little bit. I say it selfishly, I'm a little proud of the work Katie and I have done specifically with the committee, that the payer advisory committee got so much information or so many tasks that we thought we could help with. We created subgroups of that committee. And one of the big ones that we created last year was a Medicare Advantage work group. And who knew that that would come to such a forefront of the industry as it has? And I have never seen in my 30 years that it becomes such a hot topic of Medicare Advantage, how they're taking advantage, and, you know, health plans exiting, you know, Medicare Advantage plans. And we thought that was going to be an issue over a year ago and created this subgroup because we didn't have enough time in our main committee to talk about how can we collaborate together to educate our patients, to learn lessons of some other states. I think Florida did it, and I'm trying to remember who the other state that really started it, put out a lot of information. So the VHA helped us gather how to educate patients, how to show them how Medicare Advantage works, what kind of choices they have, so that when things happen like the end of this year with all the noise on Medicare Advantage, we have a toolkit, we have information, and we have education on our community to share, you know, what choices patients have about changing plans, about going back to traditional fee-for-service Medicare, how that works. The more we could educate, and that's a direct relationship with that payer advisory committee, that we have those tools right now.
Great. That's really, so I heard you both really reference more or less incremental sustainable steps toward making the whole process, the whole system better, if you can, that's for sure. As we kind of start to wrap this up a little bit, just any closing thoughts from either of you on maybe some specific things that your organizations are doing aside from the committee, just to improve your outcomes with payers and what you're doing to hold them more accountable? Anything you can share?
Well, I mean, sure. We're constantly having conversations and meetings with payers, using data to hold them accountable. But one thing we hadn't talked about yet that's connected to the Payer Advisory Committee, and it's something that I know, I don't want to speak for Bob, but Bob and I are both very passionate about, is the Payer Scorecard, which is a tool that is collecting information from organizations. We have over 50% of the Virginia hospitals feeding information into the Payer Scorecard. The scorecard aggregates it and normalizes it. So if Bob and I were to produce some type of reporting or stats out of our individual organizations, it's going to be how we're interpreting it and how we're pulling that information out of our systems. The Payer Scorecard normalizes all of that. You ask what we've done to maybe improve the payer relationship or what we've used. I don't shy away from accountability at all. One of the powers of the payer scorecard is that at a meeting I was at, I was showing the payer de-identified information, showed them where they were on this particular metric, and then blanked out the other payers, showed them where they were in the state, and also for my organization, how they ranked against the other payers. And when you show them data that is not produced by me, has not been layered, I haven't layered anything on top of it, that is produced by a third party, it gets their attention. And I was surprised somewhat to see how much they care about that. Payers are very competitive. They don't want to be in last place. So when you're able to show them information like that, it's really helpful. So I've used that tool a lot, Bill. I don't know if that directly answered your question, but I've used that tool for payer conversations.
And the data is more current. The data is more current, I recall, from what we talked about. It's what's kind of what's happening today versus 2 or 3 years ago, which sometimes is an issue,
right,
with the statistics.
And I can mention, you know, the best thing that I get out of all of that, that maybe is not generally the payer advisory committee is networking with my colleagues that, you know, through that organization and through HFMA and through AHAM, you know, you have friends out there, you know, like in Virginia, you know, Katie, myself, and then a couple of our, the incoming chair and incoming vice chair, we're on a little bit of an email chat group. And, you know, we talk, we bring up issues, you know, success with vendor partnerships or things like that. In general, we don't strategize, we don't cross any lines, but we say, have you seen this? How are you handling this denial? How are you doing this work? That's probably been the most powerful thing, besides the payer scorecarding, has been that I can talk to a peer relatively pretty quickly. I don't have to wait for a meeting. I don't have to post it on a message board. I can create an email right now to the three of them, and we're instantly collaborating about a common issue or that they haven't seen, or have you seen this? Payers love to sneak new regulations in their provider updates. And unless you've got someone, you know, run, and who's going to sit there and read provider updates every day? But when you run across one, we'll share one and say, hey, have you noticed payer X is now denying this claim? And, you know, lights click on, and then all of a sudden we're connected and we're seeing how it's done. So the power of data, the power of collaboration are huge with what we do.
It has brought a level of networking and collaboration that I haven't been used to. So it used to be, oh my gosh, I'm struggling with this. Let me call my friend Bob. Now my first place is, let me go see if everybody else in Virginia is having a problem first. And then I'll call my friend Bob. And if he's doing better than me, I'll ask what the heck he's up to. If he's not doing as good as me or if there's a common theme there, then it's, let's bring this up at the payer advisory committee and see how widespread it is.
Yeah, that's great. Heather and Valerie, wouldn't you agree that this is more the exception than the rule from what you're hearing out there, what Virginia's doing?
Yeah,
I would love to see every state do this. Yeah.
There's pockets of, like, you know, your state AHA trying to bring folks together, but, you know, places that I've been, it hasn't been that level of camaraderie and collaboration in an organized fashion either. And a lot of institutions, frankly, don't want to give up their data for a payer scorecard. You know, that's a big deal. They're just not willing to share at that level. It sort of puts a little damper on the initiative, but it's good to see that you guys kind of worked through that.
It might be helpful really quick to know that I cannot see any other individual hospital's information. I can see my own, and then I can see the roll up by state and the nation. So that's, there was a little bit of hesitation. Augusta Health happened to be the first one to jump on in Virginia, and I think Bob was close after me. There was some hesitation there, but once some of the other providers started to see how we were able to utilize the data and how, I hate to use the word safe, but how safe it was, de-identified, they scrubbed the PHI out of it, is very low risk. We were able to gain some more involvement.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Yep.
There, Valerie, anything else you wanted to ask before we close it out?
I don't know if there's anything I want to ask except, you know, maybe try to get on the speaking circuit, encourage you guys maybe going out there and trying to present so other states can figure out how do they do the same thing. Because as I said before, I would love to see every state do this. I know I had my payer scorecard, but I was saying I had the luxury of having access to data and have industrial engineers who could do it for me. And it was only my data. How powerful could it have been had I been able to see if it was just a me issue with that payer, or is it broader? And, you know, I talked about, I use the data to say, do I have a process issue or a payer issue? But it would have been so much more powerful if I knew the hospital across the street and the one down the road were also struggling, and we could have come together going, hey, let's collectively address this. So I encourage you guys to get on the speaking circuit, do more things like this, but start talking about, like, hey, let's put together, here's the roadmap, how we kicked it off, and let's try to encourage other states to do the same thing. So thank you guys for sharing this today.
Not to mention,
I can say they're both very generous. They're both
very generous. It generates some competition.
There you go.
Between Bob and I, too. Where I'm like, where's your denials this month, buddy?
Exactly. Exactly. Healthy competition.
Great. Heather, were you going to say something? I'm sorry, I cut you off.
I think, you know, just as our normal kind of part of wrap up, I just think if you, Katie and Bob, could just think of three things, like, even if you don't have a, you know, the ability to pull this all together in your state or with your group, like, what are three things somebody could do now to kind of at least get on the right track, at least start something like this?
Find even a smaller group. If you cannot get organized on a state level, there's bound to be at conferences, at meetings, that you're going to know people in your area that may not be fully organized like Virginia is, but start a small network, start a small text chain or an email chain with three or four revenue cycle leaders, and be amazed at how it grows from that point, where you have that ability to just, in the middle of our days, as you all do, multiple screens and messages flying all over, if I could just paste an email out there to four people that do what I do in the state that I work in or the region I work in, that information is invaluable. I've learned so much from these other folks that I've been able to come back and use. That start there. Start at the grassroots level yourself, and just start a group of three or four of you that do what you do, understand the pain that you go through, and that you can talk to as much as anyone, because they do exactly what you do. And there's not that many of us. So, you know, it's a small group.
I think that's great. And then none of us have all the answers. So I think being honest with yourself, that there, as many years as anybody has been in revenue cycle, and I've been in it for quite a while, I don't have all the answers. Things are always changing. We don't have to solve it alone. You know, revenue cycle operation and leadership can feel kind of like a lonely little journey. And it can feel very stressful. There's days when the entire organization's financial status feels as though it's resting on your shoulders. It's not necessarily always true, but if the payments aren't coming in the door, then, you know, that's putting the hospital and our missions at risk. But we don't have to do this alone. And having a group of individuals, ours happens to be the Payer Advisory Committee, but even if you build a group of individuals outside of an organized group or committee, just build those relationships and rely on each other and ask the silly questions. Even, I can't tell you how many times I've been like, I don't understand this. I feel a little ignorant on this topic. Can somebody teach me? We all want to teach each other. We're all in this together.
Yeah, that's great. And I would probably say just, you know, dive into the data. Your data is a great source of information as it relates to these payer claims and payer issues and whatnot. So thank you so much for joining us today. I mean, we wish you both really continued success with the work that you're doing. I did want to emphasize to both of you really quick, I know how important culture is in your success. And I know that you both work with some really great teams who together, you know, work toward better serving your patients and working together to solve some of the challenges that we face in this industry every day. So keep up the good work there. It's oftentimes a thankless job, but we appreciate it so much. I'm going to close this out with a couple of quick quotes today. The first one is, and I'm sure many of you have heard this, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. The other one is, collaboration is the key that unlocks the door to innovation. So with that, we will wrap up this episode of The Shift RCM Talks. I want to thank our guests today, Katie Adams and Bob Booz from Virginia. Thank you to Valerie and Heather for their participation. I'm Bill Eichest, and we look forward to your feedback when this episode comes out in early December, and look forward to providing future episodes of the podcast. So be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, everybody, and happy holidays. Guys.
Thanks, everyone. Yeah.